Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Sunday Brunch here on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin. Coming up today, how did time in an asylum affect Vincent van Gogh and his artwork? We meet the indie publishers Charco Press. Also ahead...
I'm a big believer in the first step in conservation is to fall in love with the natural world, to experience it and to soak it up.
Aaron Miller on the best national parks in the world. And
it's about the quality of produce, it's about training of the staff, it's about the belief that we got to do the best we can do, make sure the customer has a great experience. It's about hospitality. So even though the styles of food and the ingredients that we use are slightly different, the same values run through all of those restaurants.
We discuss what makes a great restaurant. Plus, Cornelia Mayer will go through the weekend papers with me. So, all that to come live this hour with me, Georgina Godwin, on Sunday Brunch. To begin today's show, the year of 1889 was one of significance for Vincent van Gogh. It was when he spent time in an asylum in the south of France after he mutilated his ear. However, it was also a time that he created some of his most interesting work. So how did this period in the asylum affect van Gogh and who did he meet along the way? Martin Bailey is the author of Starry Night, a book that looks into this, and he joins me in the studio now to reveal all. Well, thank you so much for coming in, Martin. This is a fascinating book and just beautifully, beautifully done with a lot of original images, some photographs you've taken yourself, and of course, some reproductions of Van Gogh's work. Let's start by putting the asylum stay into context, though. I wonder if you could tell us what was going on in Van Gogh's life before he went there.
Well, the Christmas before, the Christmas of 1888, Van Gogh was living in the Yellow House and he was sharing it with Paul Gauguin, the artist, and they'd spent 2 months together. And then just before Christmas, there was some terrible incident. We don't know all of the details, but Van Gogh mutilated, cut off most of his ear, and then Gauguin fled back to Paris. And for a few months, Vincent was in a hospital in Arles, but it was clear that he had some mental problem which had developed. And his doctors said that he ought to go to an asylum. And Van Gogh almost ended up at two terrible places, the asylum at Marseille and Aix-en-Provence. They were very large towns or cities, and they had over 1,000 patients, and that would have been absolutely terrible. Mm. Fortunately, Vincent was sent to a much, much smaller asylum run by Catholics at Saint-Paul-de-Mussol, which was not far away from Arles. And this was a much smaller asylum, and he therefore had the freedom to do what he wanted and paint.
And a terrifying decision, really, for him, because he was, at the beginning, decided to be a voluntary patient. But this was not the first time that he'd had a brush with this. When he was much younger, his father had thought about sending him to asylum in Belgium.
He was an awkward teenager. He was even more difficult as an adult. And he obviously had some mental problems. Doctors have spent put great efforts in trying to discover what the cause of his problem is and haven't come to any definitive conclusion. I, as a non-specialist, a non-medical specialist, I suspect it may have been a combination of problems, some hereditary and some other problems. So he had had a difficult time. But until the ear incident, there was nothing that was that serious.
Yeah, but here it was finally, and he'd mutilated himself terribly and then decided to go into the asylum. Now, very little has been written previously about this time, and Van Gogh himself hardly refers to it in his letters from there. I wonder what prompted you to dig into it.
Well, I'd done a book on the Arles period, which was called Studio of the South, and this was a natural follow-up. But I was interested and intrigued as to what life had been like at the asylum, and that's why I decided to write Starry Night. And all biographers of Van Gogh just rely on the letters, which are fascinating and they're available online and easily accessible. But Vincent doesn't really write much about daily life at the asylum. I mean, there are two possible reasons. One is that he didn't want to, he wanted to spare his brother Theo from the horrible details of life there. Or maybe he just wanted to switch off. So the letters don't tell us very much. So for Starry Night, I did some digging in the archives. I found a register, which has not been published, of all the patients that were there. And there were only 18 male patients. So I was able to identify most of the patients by name and also by their medical conditions. And that revealed that actually they were in very poor shape, the other patients. And it is astonishing when you think that Van Gogh was living, you know, he was having breakfast with these patients, some of whom couldn't even speak or who sort of mumbled incoherent sounds, you know, threw their food around. You know, he was living very close to these people, and yet he managed to produce all of these marvelous pictures, you know, the olive groves, the cypress trees, the Starry Night painting.
Absolutely. And through this new research that you've dug up, you were able to construct a much more thorough portrait of his day-to-day life there. And as you say, of the other patients who you have names for, you have their conditions, all sorts of detail.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. And it was a period when they knew very little about the causes of mental problems or indeed the treatment. So there's actually no treatment. They actually recommended baths. That was all there was. There was no sort of medication. And I think in a way, Vincent managed to survive the year in the asylum because he had his art. The other patients were completely bored, sat around, just got frustrated. Vincent, all of his waking hours when he could, he would either work outside in the walled garden of the asylum. Sometimes he was allowed out for short periods to paint in the olive groves. When the weather was bad, he would sit in his studio and paint. And that gave him a sort of means of escape. And it also gave him a reason to live. And it's very interesting, of course, that when he left the asylum, his life was tragically short.
You have been afforded a tremendous opportunity, and not one given to many, to actually go into the asylum, to be in the places where he would have been, and in fact to look at those views from his perspective.
Yes, I mean, it was many years ago. I went to the asylum and visited it. It was very difficult to get in, because it's still actually a mental hospital, a psychiatric hospital. So I went in with the director many years ago at a time when the patients were having their meals and not in the places that I was going to. But it is very interesting to see how the place has developed. You can see the corridor that he painted, the view of the hall that he painted, the garden. And, of course, much has changed, but much also remains the same. But it's now a completely modern and up-to-date psychiatric hospital.
Of course, the wonderful almond tree. You think you've probably found the very one, although very sensibly you're not saying where.
Yes, I mean, one of the most beautiful paintings, arguably the most beautiful, is of the almond blossom, which Vincent painted towards the end of his stay there. You know, lovely sort of white petals against a turquoise sky. And I met two elderly residents of Saint-Rémy who told me that they knew where the actual tree was. Now, they took me to the tree, and I looked at it carefully. Almond trees can last for 150 years, so this could well have survived. And the evidence they gave me was fairly strong, but not conclusive. So it could be a sort of direct living link with Van Gogh's time, which is interesting. Now, in the book, I just show a little corner of the tree, because what we don't want is tourists coming to pick the branches. It was all right when Van Gogh did it because he took three branches to paint. So that was well worth it. But we don't want the tree to suffer.
Absolutely. Now, the book is called Starry Night. And, of course, that's the name of one of the paintings. And you went to the Royal Observatory at Greenwich to have a look at what the stars might have seen, how they might have seemed to him from his room.
Yes, I mean, what I was interested to know was whether the famous Starry Night painting, which is in New York, was an actual, was based on an actual scene or on Van Gogh's imagination. So I went to the Royal Observatory at Greenwich, and they very kindly programmed the night sky to show me what it would have been like on that particular night, on that particular location. And it was It was very interesting. Perhaps no surprise, it seems that Van Gogh took various elements of the sky at different times. It was not something he saw at one particular moment. There was partly a morning view and partly an evening view. So Van Gogh had used his imagination to take part of the night sky. And remember that, you know, there was very little to do in the evenings when it was dark there. He would have been alone in his room, and he wouldn't necessarily have wanted to sleep all hours. So looking out of the window was something to do. And one also must remember that the window had bars, so he was actually looking at the night sky through these bars.
He left the asylum finally on the 16th of May, and as you say, by the 29th of July, he was dead. Why did he leave, and what happened in those weeks between his discharge and his death?
Well, he stayed almost exactly a year. It was a year and 1 week. And he, in the end, he became very frustrated and was determined to leave. I'm not sure that it was necessarily a good idea, but he put pressure on his doctor and he put pressure on his brother, Theo, and said he wanted to leave. So that was agreed. And he then went to the village of Auvers-sur-Oise, which is just north of Paris, so he could keep in touch with his brother who was working in the capital. And things seemed to go fine. He was there for 2 months. He painted very productively. And then suddenly something went wrong. Somehow he got a gun and he went up to the wheat fields where he was painting and he shot himself in the stomach. I mean, it has been suggested that it was murder recently in a recent biography, but I'm convinced that it was suicide. And it was something sudden that came upon him. And he shot himself in the wheat fields. He then staggered back, and it's amazing to think he was able to walk, but he staggered back to the little inn where he was staying, and they noticed something was wrong then, and the doctors came, but 2 days later, he was dead.
Mm. What do you think, then, he took away from that asylum experience?
Well, I think he really became a landscape painter when he was in Provence, not surprisingly, because we all love the landscape of Provence and particularly that area. And, you know, it is amazing. It's beautiful. The olive trees with their sort of gnarled trunks and silvery leaves and the tall cypress trees. He really loved the landscape. And that's what absorbed him. So I think he really became a landscape painter when he was there. And those are mostly the paintings that the public today, 70 years later, after he couldn't sell his work, go mad for.
And it's tragic to think that had he not discharged himself, there would be probably a whole other body of work.
Yes, I mean, he was 37 when he died, so he was just beginning to be accepted. And I think we just see him now as the artist who couldn't sell his work, who was rejected. But another point that I make in Starry Night is that his paintings were actually seen by the president of France. There's a brief reference in a letter from Theo to say that his paintings had been exhibited at the Salon des Indépendants and the president of France had come for the opening. And I looked in newspaper reports and the president had actually spent 1 hour in the exhibition and had been taken round by Signac, another artist who was a very close friend of Vincent. So this rejected artist had actually been seen by the French president.
Which really goes some way to vindicating all of that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's clear that this is a work of love. You really enjoyed writing it, I can tell.
Yes. I mean, it's great fun. It's great fun researching something like that. It's also fun putting the book together because it's illustrated led, so there are lots of illustrations and fresh illustrations, and I tried to look at the subject fresh and avoid the cliches that so dominate the Van Gogh literature.
Well, I think you've done so magnificently. Starry Night, Van Gogh at the Asylum is published by White Lion. It's written by Martin Bailey. Martin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Now, still to come, what makes a good restaurant and some of the world's best national parks? Stay tuned.
They've reported, listened, watched, quizzed and cajoled. They've been to farms and galleries, conclaves and bars. They've reported from the high north and tropical metropolises. And you? Well, all you need to do is turn the dial, click our app or pop in your headphones and head off on an audio tour of the spikiest, juiciest, funniest moments from Monocle 24's Week That Was. The Curator is our one-hour show that informs, entertains and surprises with the best bits of all our magazine shows, from The Urbanist to The Menu, The Stack to The Entrepreneurs, Culture to Section D, premiering live every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time. You can also subscribe to the programme at monocle.com or on iTunes or on SoundCloud to ensure that you never miss a beat. Come on, let's catch up this weekend. Listen to The Curator.
Now, why are a New Zealander and an Argentinian living in Scotland publishing Latin American literature? Well, I asked the founders of Edinburgh's Charco Press, Samuel McDull, and his partner Carolina Orloff, to tell me more.
We found that people's references to Latin American literature were very dated. They always step back to the classics, to Borges, to García Márquez, fantastic writers, but a lot's happened in these countries, a lot's happened in the literature in these countries in the 30 or 40 years since those authors were prevalent. And we thought that it was about time that we started to provide a bit of exposure for these authors to readers in English.
So, Carolina, you started this press at the same time, in fact, that you had a baby. It seems like a really big undertaking, and also to do it here in Scotland. Why?
I guess there are times in your life where, without realizing, you just throw yourself in the deep end of everything. And for us, that was having a baby and starting our own business. I wouldn't do it like that again, if you asked me. But I guess you have this energy when you're parenting as well, that you feel that you, if you're parenting, you can do anything. It's exhausting, but it's working out fine, I think. And
so who's your target market?
That's a very good question. I think there are two target markets in my head. The real target market and the one I'd like it to be. At the moment, there's a lot of readers that read us because they're interested in literature in translation, and maybe they're interested particularly in Latin America, maybe academics as well, that they're interested in more the research behind certain topics or certain trends that these writers are dealing with. So that's the real one. And the one I'm aiming for is just people that are interested in good fiction. So we're constantly talking about this, sparking the conversation about changing that. I feel it's a reduction of literature in translation just to be that, you know, and you have people that love it and follow us and are very loyal, and people that just won't go near it just because it's translated. And we just want to, you know, bridge that and go, well, these are really, really good books. Not necessarily they're going to be difficult or, you know, niche just because they've been translated. They're just good books, good stories.
Well, exactly. And that's your point, isn't it? That these are books that should be read by everybody. And in fact, in the English-speaking world, we only read such a small proportion of the great number of books that come out every year.
It's not so much we personally think that these are books that should be read here or in the US or in other English-speaking countries. It's more a point that people should have the choice. They should have the option. They should have them on the shelves to choose from them. They should be able to pick up this literature, these stories, listen to these voices from different parts of the world. And it's just not the way it is right now. And now we hope that will change with time, and that's what we're trying to do, our own little piece towards that. But it really is around saying, you know, we think this is a great literature, and over here you've never had the chance to read it before, now you've got the opportunity. If people read it, love it, great. If they don't, great. But at least now they're starting to get some choices.
So how do you go about choosing the writers?
That's one of the best parts of the job, I think, because I just get to read and read and read. There's a lot of reading the actual novels. I'm reading them in Spanish and in my very poor Portuguese as well, what comes from Brazil. But there's also a lot of kind of peripheral reading, as in reading about book festivals in Latin America, reading about what other authors are recommending, and also studying the catalogues of publishers that I admire and that I know that are very precise in what their choices are.
So are you publishing books that have already been published in Spanish, or are you publishing people who've never been published before as well?
At the moment, we're concentrating on books that have been published already and that have won prizes and have made the name for authors like Daniel Mesha. Sometimes we're going for the debut novels of certain authors. Sometimes we're going for the book that has changed the status of a certain author and has made them, you know, a different kind of writer now, a more famous writer. Mm-hmm. So we try to vary the kind of book we publish, but they've all been originally published in Spanish or Portuguese. Yeah.
So you do have a very famous Uruguayan writer here with you at the moment. Tell us about him.
So Daniel Mesha is from Uruguay. He is one of the, we like to think of him as one of the leading lights of Uruguayan literature. He's been publishing books since he was 21. He took a break from writing for 10 years and then started again several years ago. His first book that he wrote after that gap won the Bartolome Hidalgo Prize, which is the highest literary prize in Uruguay. The second book he wrote after that won the same prize again, and that's the book that we've just published, his older brother, in English.
So, Daniel, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Why did you stop writing for 10 years?
Because I wanted to stop being a writer. I actually wanted to stop being myself, because I felt I had identified too much with being a writer. I was constantly thinking about writing. Writing a good page made my day. Writing a bad page ruined it. Constantly thinking about the next book, always being unsatisfied, felt like I was being kind of shallow. You know what I mean? I felt like I had become suddenly part of a very small group of people who thought literature was everything. So...
Isn't it?
It's... In a way it is, because everything is story. In a way, everything is literature. Everything can be told. The way we understand the world is by telling us ourselves a story. But I guess I just needed to... I promised myself I would only go back to writing if I could do it from a different angle. You know, or if I could sort of learn how to do it more organically, so to speak. You know what I mean? In a way, I felt sick. You know, and I felt like I needed to recover. I think I was too little, too successful, and too young. You know what I mean?
You have a fascinating backstory. You were a Mormon, a basketball player, a surfer. You've done all of these things, and it must be pretty amazing to come out of what is really a very small place, Uruguay, with a small population, with that huge measure of success.
Yes, it is. It is. It is a, in a way, being a Uruguayan, you learn not to have many big dreams. You know, because you cannot really expect, for example, to be translated into English. That's something that rarely happens. So the fact that it's happening right now to a book of mine is a dream come true, but it's a dream that I only allowed myself very remotely, like in secret, like couldn't even admit it to myself. So I am honored and grateful for that, because it is really a rare occasion.
One of the things about literature in translation is that it is down to the skill of the translator. If you look at someone like Orhan Pamuk, who changed translators, and then suddenly his work is very, very different. And I wonder about your translation, and obviously you're fluent in English, so you can read your own translations in a critical way. What you think?
Well, when I read the first draft of the translation, I thought I was a really good writer in English. I hope I could write like that in Spanish. Megan McDowell is a brilliant translator. And I think that's one of the things that makes me feel really confident, you know, because you could end up with a bad translation of your book.
Yeah.
So we talked about it, like we talked on the phone a couple of times. I was really fascinated by how deeply she had read the book and how she had understood the questions that she had about the book were really interesting, and I was really like satisfied and happy that it was so good.
You're a translator. It's a difficult job.
It is a very difficult job, very unappreciated, I think, although that's gratefully changing. But it is a very difficult job, and almost it could be an eternal job, in the sense that it's very hard to let go, as I'm sure it is for a writer, but I guess for a translator you always think that you can improve it just a little bit more, or you can find that word that you couldn't really think of when you were looking for it. So it is a very difficult job, but it's very rewarding too, because you are carrying a work into a new language. You're rewriting, I think, you're reinventing a book, a story, an author. So it's a very responsible job, I think.
Is there a temptation to improve the actual words, not just translate them, but think, you know what, actually it should maybe be a little bit more like this?
Oh, yes. Yes. And that's a constant conversation to be had if the possibility exists between the translator and the author and the editor as well in the middle. Yeah, and that also varies. You know, some authors want to get really involved in the translation process, whether or not they understand English. You know, it's just about the music, the tone, the poetry, which is very interesting in itself. And some authors just want to hand, you know, complete responsibility to the translator and the copy editor and the editor. So that varies a lot with each book and each translation and each author. But all in all, yes, there's always a temptation to put your own kind of grain of salt of creativity in that kind of, oh, I think, you know, I could make this.
I think that's one of the interesting things that happened to me with Megan's translation. Usually I think of translation, like the best translations I've read are usually done by people who are very immersed in writing, who are even writers themselves in a sense. Even maybe they're not published authors, but they are writers because they, what does a writer do? A writer makes language do something that only he or she can make it do that. So in a way, when Borges translates, he's translating Edgar Allan Poe's English into Borges's Spanish. It's not translating from an abstract English into an abstract Spanish. There's no such thing. There is a Borges Spanish and there is an Edgar Allan Poe English. What I felt Megan has is like she has her own English. So I think she could sort of perceive the Daniel Misha Spanish and do it into the Megan McDowell's English. In that way, a translator has to be able to put that grain of salt, because that's like even a responsibility, I think.
Well, that was the voice of the Uruguayan author Daniel Mecha, and before him Sam McDowell and Carolina Orloff. Daniel's book is The Older Brother. It's published by Charco Press, which is run by both Samuel and Carolina. Now, we were speaking in Scotland, where the Edinburgh International Book Festival continues until the 27th of August. So now it's time for a regular Sunday brunch feature called Weekend Reads. And this week I met Aaron Miller. His new book, The 50 Greatest National Parks of the World, is an introduction to the most beautiful protected natural landscapes on the planet, from world famous icons like Yosemite to little visited gems like Zambia's North Luangwa, and the inside track on seeing them at their very best. He began by telling me about a recent trip to one of them.
I was in Yosemite, which I know is one of the most famous national parks in the world. But for me, it was one of the most beautiful landscapes I've ever seen. Yosemite Valley is somewhere everyone should go. I hiked this 54-mile long-distance trail in the backcountry, and I did it for a week in summer when it's absolutely rammed in the valley with cars and people taking selfies everywhere you go. But if you walk a few miles up into the backcountry, you have the whole thing to yourself. It was a truly magical experience. But you know, I mean, that's for me, for hiking and for nature, that was an incredible experience. But you have parks for wildlife. I went in winter to Yellowstone, the world's first national park. It's also now the best place in the world to see wolves in the wild. They were reintroduced in the 90s to help with the elk overgrazing, which in itself is an amazing story. But to see wolves in the wild, you know, these kind of dark shadows silhouetted against the white snow and bison everywhere, is just this incredible connection to the American West, that kind of wild American West. That's one of the things that I just love about national parks. You know, they kind of represent the identity of a place, the soul of a place. And for me, when you're in a place like Yellowstone or the Grand Canyon, that's what you're getting. You're looking out across the American West and you're feeling that history. Or if you're in the Serengeti National Park, you're connecting with the spirit of the Maasai people. So there's so many different places, and there's a few on the bucket list. I'm just off in a couple of days to the Guayanas, the Haida Gwaii chain of islands in northern British Columbia, which is known as the Galapagos of the North because they are one of the most biologically rich places on Earth, but almost no one knows they exist. So I love trying to find those little corners too, which no one's been to yet as well.
Do you think that a national park as a legally protected area can actually lead to damage through mass tourism?
You know, it's a really difficult question. I know they're struggling with that with a few big national parks here. And, you know, I don't know what the best answer for that is. There's talk about raising the entrance fee, which I can understand in terms of limiting numbers. But Doug Tompkins, who was the CEO of Patagonia Clothing Company and who's done some amazing work in Patagonia with kind of expanding national lands down there, said that national parks are the greatest expression of a democracy that a country can realize, protecting its masterpieces for all future generations. And I think there's something really important in that. National parks, by definition, are ours, whereas reserves can be private property. So I think that we have to certainly protect the landscape. And I think that, you know, overcrowding is a difficult issue. But at the same time, we have to protect access for everyone, not just people that can afford it. And particularly for people that maybe don't have the opportunity to go out and experience the natural world. And I'm a big believer in the first step in conservation is to fall in love with the natural world, to experience it and to soak it up. John Muir, who did just that in Yosemite, kind of sparked the whole revolution of national parks, said, "In wildness lies the hope of the world." And I do believe that the way that we begin to care about the world and protecting it is through having empathy through that. And we develop that empathy through connecting with these incredible landscapes. And if you've never experienced that before, it's maybe hard to understand that. So I think it's important to keep that access open. But there are these intriguing arguments as well about just creating large swathes of protected land that aren't managed and preserved for human use. They're just allowed to be wild and to return to their natural state. And I think that's something that's super important. And George Monbiot discusses that in his excellent book, Feral, protecting large swathes of land and just allowing them to rewild, to return to their wild state. So I think there's maybe a place for both types of conservation.
In this lovely book, you, as the title would imply, visit 50 national parks of the world on 5 different continents. And one of the continents you go to is Africa. And so on the one hand, you've got places like Yosemite, very well known, very well visited. But you also talk about North Luangwa in Zambia, which only has 500 visitors a year. I'm very familiar with that park and also one over the Zambezi River in Zimbabwe, Mana Pools. And that, again, is a place you can only really explore on foot. And I wonder if you were tempted to leave out some of those very remote places because perhaps selfishly like me, you don't really want people to know about them.
As a travel writer, I often have that dilemma. It's one of those things where there's these incredible places and you want to kind of keep them secret and private. And I certainly do sometimes do that or certainly feel that. You know, in the case of Luangwa, I guess I wanted to try and get across what that feeling is of that truly wild Africa, you know, before there were roads and safari parks. And, you know, you can go to Africa and you can have an incredible safari experience with, you know, the typical experiences on a car and a truck and you're driving around and you're experiencing this incredible wildlife. But obviously it's a completely different thing on foot where you're on a level pegging all of a sudden. But it's so important to, I think, try and get across the feeling of that. You know, that's one of the things I was hoping for this book to do, that it's not just a guidebook. I mean, hopefully there's some good tips in there and some amazing things you can see along the way. But I really wanted to get across the feeling of it. And I think that some of these really remote places that people haven't visited, they're hard to get to. Some of them are expensive. So I think numbers are kind of naturally kept down for the time being anyway. But there's something so incredible about being in a place like that where hardly anyone's been. And I wanted to try and get across what it felt like to be there. You know, what does it feel like to be in Canaima National Park in Venezuela, looking up at the world's tallest waterfall, you know, a waterfall that's so tall that if you're on the top of the Empire State Building, you wouldn't even reach halfway up. By the time the water has come down to you, it's evaporated to a mist because it's fallen so far. And at the top of these incredible flat top mesas, the tepuis where Angel Falls pours out of, many of them are still unexplored. You know, we still don't know what's on the top of those places. And so one of my things I really hope for this book to do, I suppose, is to take people on these kind of snapshot adventures of all these incredible places around the world and tell the history and the stories and the myths around them. But more than anything, to try and get across just for a brief instant of what it feels like emotionally to be there and to experience that kind of wonder and amazement. And to know that the world is filled with these places still, you know, I think that it's easy to forget in our kind of busy modern lives, often urban lives, how absolutely teeming with amazement this planet is, and how we're a part of that, and how it's waiting for us to explore it. So I hope there's still enough undiscovered pockets of the world that we can leave protected, but hopefully there's a few in here that will inspire you to go and see them too.
And that was Aaron Miller. The 50 Greatest National Parks of the World is out now. And to hear more from authors, check out Meet the Writers. You can find the full back catalogue online at monocle.com. Well, it's time now to look through the weekend papers, and I'm joined in the studio by Cornelia Mayer, CEO of Mayer Resources, a business consultancy. Welcome. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. So, of course, the story that's leading in all the television bulletins and indeed across the front pages that came out late enough is the death of John McCain.
Yes, and I think we've chosen The Guardian Online. And, you know, it really shows very well what a giant of politicians he was. There is this former prisoner of war in Vietnam who refused to be released when he was offered a release because his father was a four-star admiral. A man who then moved into politics, was very conservative, but always reached across the divide and always worked with people. I think Barack Obama summed it up very nicely when he said, "Fidelity to ideals for which generations of Americans and immigrants alike have fought, marched, and sacrificed." Mm. I think that really sort of gets the sentiment of who he was very much.
Mm. I think there's always the danger when somebody dies, though, for certainly in the obits, but for it to become a kind of hagiography of the person. Yeah. And we mustn't forget that, of course, McCain was the person that brought us Sarah Palin as his running mate.
That's exactly as I said. The one thing I couldn't forgive him for is that he brought us Sarah Palin, because after her came the Tea Party movement, and out of that emerged the people who supported Trump. But then you also have to say he really did stand up to Trump. And he did stand up when Trump pilloried a Muslim hero who had died in the war and was really nasty to the family. McCain was the one who said, "This is not on." And he was also the one who, when he was already very ill, went back just to cast his vote so Obamacare could be maintained. So in that sense, he had the right values. But I have to say, Sarah Palin, that is, we can't forget. And he is a Republican. He is conservative, but he moderated his conservatism. He started out being very anti-immigrant, then saying we need to find accommodations. He started out being against gay marriage, then being for gay marriage and for helping gay people. So he did evolve.
Yeah. There's one great quote that I'd like to give from him, because this was something he said in October after he received the Liberty Medal in Philadelphia. And this is The Guardian says that many people see this as a repudiation of Trump's America First ethos. He said, "To fear the world we have organized and led for three quarters of a century, to abandon the ideals we have advanced around the globe, to refuse the obligations of international leadership and our duty to remain the last best hope of Earth for the sake of some half-baked, spurious nationalism cooked up by people who would rather find scapegoats than solve problems is as unpatriotic as an attachment to any other tired dogma of the past that Americans consign to the ash heap of history."
Absolutely. And that ties in very nicely with how Obama had paraphrased him.
Yeah, fantastic. And what a great man who will be sadly missed, men like him at the leadership of...
And especially in the Congress now, they do need leaders like him. Another thing that you saw when you saw the television programs, he was very much liked by senators, and he mentored younger senators. Mm. So he was truly somebody who reached across the divide.
Mm. Well, let's talk about another leader now, and he too is making huge waves by turning away from those who have gone before him. I'm talking now of the Pope, who is in Ireland today. Huge mass happening. I think 500,000 people expected to turn up at Phoenix Park this afternoon for his mass. Now, what's extraordinary about this visit is, of course, it's been 40 years since the Pope went to Ireland, and it's a much, much changed environment. And the Pope himself is saying things that would never have been said before.
Absolutely. And I mean, this article in El País basically says, look how changed this country was. This was a very devout, Catholic, conservative country. And now, you know, you just had a few weeks back, abortion was legalized. You have gay marriage. You have all sorts of things that go against sort of the credo of the church. And this is a very unusual church. But there was also the speech by Leo Varadkar, the prime minister, where he said, you know, that the abuses, the sexual abuses of the church, you know, the church needs to take swift action. And when you look at, he gave a speech and he met for an hour with six victims of abuse. And he basically, the Pope was unequivocally says, yes, we have to do things against that. We have to condemn it. But in Ireland and around the world, people say actions now need to follow the words. But let's just, you know, go a little bit back. His predecessor, Benedict, former Cardinal Ratzinger, would never have said anything like that. Neither would John Paul II. But John Paul II was a different man of a different generation, and he was all about getting rid of communism. So this is, but in this generation, he's really pushing that issue forward as much as he can, because he also has cardinals back home that he needs to bring along.
Sure. And I mean, he's been criticised, as we mentioned in our news bulletin today, about having known about some of this abuse and not demanding resignations from people. But I suppose the thing is, he's doing it now.
He's doing it now, and he also has to bring, you know, he's the leader, and he's like an absolute monarch. But there's a lot of cardinals, and there's a lot of politics in the Vatican, and he has to deal with that as well. He has to make, as every leader has, they have to make it, whatever it is, work.
It's extraordinary, isn't it, how powerful the Catholic Church still is. I mean, even though the crowd is down on what it would have been 40 years ago, there are billions of Catholics in the world.
And you know, it's let's not just look at Europe or North America. Let's look at Latin America. Let's look at huge swaths of Asia. I used to live in the Philippines. You know, it's a very, very Catholic country. And I think, you know, the real, you know, stalwart of Catholicism these days you find in places like the Philippines, like Argentina, like you know, in emerging economies.
Let's move on now to some of the German papers. Now, one of the stories they're picking out there is cooperation between Russia, Iran and Turkey. Give us the detail on that.
Yeah, well, they are saying, you know, that it's very clear now that thanks to Russia and thanks to Iran, Assad is going to stay in power. But there is this last remaining peace that Assad wants to gain power over, which is Idlib, which is close to the Turkish border. So you have seen a lot of diplomacy going back and forth between Russia and Turkey, looking at how they could cooperate. Everybody hopes that one can find some solution of maybe disarmament of rebels and putting them into Turkish held territory, so you don't have the Assad forces going in there, because the toll of the civil population would be huge. There are 3 million people living in Idlib. 1 million of those are displaced people from other parts of Syria. If you just see the humanitarian crisis that has been brought about by Syria, it's just terrible.
Now, of course, Idlib is meant to be a de-escalation zone. It was set up by Russia and Turkey and Iran through talks, through the Astana peace process, I think it was.
Yes, exactly. But if you look at Russian military history, and not just Soviet history, you can go back into Tsarist military history. They had a history of making de-escalation zones, you know, if they didn't have enough resources to go after everything at once. And then they went after the de-escalation de-escalation zones one by one by one. So that's the oldest trick in the book if you're aware of Russian military history.
Yeah. Let's move on now to take it back to Britain and our National Health Service. And this is an extraordinary story that there are millions of patients who don't actually exist.
Well, 3.6 million, and they've cost us last year, I think, 550 million, half a billion. Thank you very much. But I spoke to one of your colleagues who said she used to work in a doctor's surgery, and the way the administration process works of the NHS, not all of this was malevolent. Some of it is just happening, but it just shows how the deep trouble the NHS is in and how it's desperately in need of reform.
Yeah, but I mean, I suppose the thing about ghost patients is that every doctor gets paid. I think it's £151 a year. Every NHS doctor gets paid £150 a year for each patient on their books, whether or not they see them.
Yeah.
So the more patients you have, obviously, the better. The more money.
But you know,
get.
But we are not like some countries where you have to tell the authorities when you're moving house. So a lot of people move house and forget to inform. So I'm sure not everything was malevolent.
Yeah, a lovely story. Story here, admittedly from The Sun, amongst the ghost patients were a person who died 42 years ago and a patient called M. Mouse. fabricated by a Scottish GP to fill up gaps in their schedule. So I'm guessing you're thinking, I want an extra long lunch break here. Oh, M. Mouse is coming with his knee problem.
I think that's fantastic. That's, as long as it's not Donald Duck.
Now, Jeremy Corbyn and his problems continue. The far right has come out for him, as reports The Times and The Observer. Very interesting tweets coming from various people saying that if you had put the word black or Asian where Corbyn had said Zionist, he would have been long gone.
I'm not sure about that, but it's clearly not acceptable. And his excuse is lame when he said, well, he wasn't referring to Zionists as Jews. He was referring to Zionists as people who created Israel. So that really didn't wash. So I wonder how much longer he's tenable for the Labour Party, because clearly, you know, in modern day Britain, this is not acceptable.
What do The Times and The Observer say about it all?
Well, they say that once now that the politicians, the MPs are coming back from summer recess and we're getting into, you know, party conference season, this will hot up and he will have a very hard time, because there were quite a few sort of big names in the Labour Party who said, no, we cannot stand behind that. But the problem is, who are you going to get in for him?
Absolutely. Now, just before you go, I want to know if you have a lovely monocle tote bag.
No, I don't.
Well, we've got to sort that out for you, because
otherwise
you're going to be playing 10p for a plastic bag, says the Telegraph.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And as I just said, I mean, it is, but you know, the 5p rule got us to consume less than 85% less plastic bags. That's quite an achievement. And you know, really the big push came after the Blue Planet movie, which goes us to show that television still can move public opinion.
That's very true. We're all very aware of plastics now, I think. But what I find extraordinary is you're standing at the supermarket counter and you think, I've just agreed to pay £30 for a bottle of champagne, and I'm mentally going, no, but I'll take the 5p bag, not the 10p one. Why do people's brains work like that? It's extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. And I actually use my plastic bags to put sweaters in and shawls in, so the moths don't eat them.
Yes.
So I actually do reuse them.
Well, I think it's all a good thing. But Cornelia, I hope that we can find you a monocle tote bag. And to all of our listeners, of course, if you subscribe, you get one for free. Cornelia Mayer, thanks so much for coming into the studio. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. And finally, having helped run Galvin Restaurants and Pub Company, Warren Geraghty is no stranger to opening new restaurants. But what makes an effective one? The design? The food? The service? Well, now culinary director of Rhubarb, Warren, spoke to Fernando Augusto Pacheco and began by talking about the restaurants that Rhubarb works with.
So within Sky Garden, we have Darwin's Brasserie and we have the Fenchurch Restaurant. And then in Royal Albert Hall, we have four restaurants as well. We have a lovely restaurant at the Saatchi Gallery, just off the King's Road, called Gallery Mess. And now we're about to open Vivi on Tottenham Court Road.
Tell us a bit more about Vivi. When is it opening? And it's funny, we were just discussing about the name of the restaurant before the interview. So tell us a bit more.
Should I give it away? Should I give away where he got the name? So Vivi's at Centre Point, which is obviously an iconic building, built in 1966. So therefore, 66, V1, V1, 6, 6, Roman numerals. We got the name Vivi. And it's quite a magnificent room. So it's the bridge between the tower and the apartments that run down the side. There's three levels, someone above us, someone below us, and we're right in the middle. Beautiful glass facade on each side, looking out onto Oxford Street and out onto a lovely public area on the other side. And we've based the style of the restaurant on 66, British nostalgia. So the food, the style, the uniforms, the drinks, all harking back to that wonderful year of 66, but maybe brought up into a little contemporary style.
I mean, you're the culinary director for the group, and I was wondering, I mean, how do you manage to work with so many restaurants? Because I presume, you know, each place has their own kind of food identity as well.
Absolutely. We're very proud of that. All the restaurants have their own identity. They have a very unique style to themselves. But, you know, we have veins that run through all of them that are the same. So it's about the quality of produce. It's about training of the staff. It's about the belief that we got to do the best we can do, make sure the customer has a great experience. It's about hospitality. So even though the styles of food and the ingredients that we use are slightly different, the same values run through all of those restaurants, which makes my job, to be honest, quite easy, because everywhere I go, we know we're looking for the same thing.
And Warren, is it true that you guys are opening your first international restaurant in New York?
We are.
What can you tell us about this?
We're opening in a place called Hudson Yard in New York in March of next year. Incredibly exciting. Working in conjunction with a chef called Dan Doherty. It's going to be a version on East Meets West, based on Dan's travels around the world. Everywhere he goes, everything he eats, he writes down in his little journal. So we're translating a lot of those experiences into dishes and creating menus for the new restaurant in Hudson Yard.
And I have a curiosity. I mean, in terms of food, does it change? Do you feel like, do you have trends, for example? In 2018, people are asking more for this type of food, you know, compared to 2 years ago. Because food, especially here in London, it can be quite moved by trends in some way.
Absolutely. Trends is something which we look at. And we have an incredible creative and marketing team who do a trends document for us once every quarter, not just what London are looking at, but also what's happening in the wider culinary scene. And we pay attention to that. We don't necessarily follow it. We don't necessarily quickly jump ship from what we're doing one thing to go on to that. But you have to pay attention to what people are asking for and what people are looking at. I mean, plant-based protein, veganism is something which is not just a trend, but something that people are really enjoying now, something which we work a lot on our menus. Nostalgia is a big trend now. Great timing.
Yeah, like Vivi you were mentioning.
Vivi. I actually read that that blancmange and jelly molds are sold out in shops across the country because people have got this nostalgic leaning back towards that sort of cooking. So we pay attention to trends, but we don't necessarily follow them instantly. But they're very, very important, yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting, there's been a New York Times article by a food critic. Everybody was making fun because he was saying, oh, finally, the food scene here in London is so much better than it was 10 years ago. But 10 years ago, it was already good. So how do you see the culinary scene here in the city?
It's probably one of the most exciting cities in the world. In fact, we had a really good conversation, myself and a couple of chefs yesterday, about where we felt London was compared to New York. And there's so many young, vibrant chefs who've got some great individual thoughts that are doing their own things. I think whereas, you know, I first started in London 28 years ago, you know, it cost a fortune to get a central London Mayfair property. That's where the money was to spend in restaurants. Now you can get a nice little corner spot in the farthest east, west, north, south part of London. It doesn't matter. People are going to travel for good food and they're going to come back and back again. So I think it's made the food scene really exciting. We've got some of the greatest producers in the world really close to us now. Around, you know, we're producing even things like wasabi we're producing in Hampshire, and we can grow the best ingredients here as well, and it's very exciting.
And, you know, this show is called The Sunday Brunch Show. I wonder, what do you have?
Sunday brunch for me, if I get to have brunch. I have young children, so it's very rare. I mean, can you beat an Eggs Benedict? I don't think you can beat an Eggs Benedict as a Sunday brunch dish. I like things like in the middle of autumn when you've got beautiful set mushrooms, a really simple mushroom omelette, a little simple omelette with some set mushrooms on top. Set you up for the day, right?
Let's just come back to Vivi for a while. I mean, can you give us a taster of the menu? I mean, some of the dishes that we might
sure,
see
no, it. Love to. I mean, look, when we wrote the menu, it was quite simple. I mean, I grew up, I was born in the early 70s, but, you know, my family, I started speaking to my mum and to my mother-in-law and saying, what dishes do you remember? There was a great book written by a lady called Marguerite Patton. So we just started flicking through, and these dishes, you know, chicken Kiev, duck à l'orange, lobster thermidor, beautiful quiche, cheese souffle. So we took all of these sort of dishes and we thought, these are the things we want people to enjoy, a vol-au-vent, a deviled egg. We just looked at them, and I'm not going to say we've modernized them or changed them. We haven't. We've just applied a few modern cooking techniques just to refine them ever so slightly, but we still want them to be in a recognizable, nostalgic form. We want you to eat it and say, that takes me back. I remember that.
And that was Warren Geraghty, who is the culinary director of Rhubarb. He was speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and we do hope that he's have time today to tuck into his mushroom omelette. That's all we have time for here on this edition of Sunday Brunch. It was produced and studio managed by George McDonough, and our researcher today was Megan Atkinson. Now, I can tell you that next week, very exciting weekend read, because in August 1968, the Beatles released what was to be their highest selling single of all. It was known as Hey Jude. On the other side was Revolution. They wanted to share a B-side status. And the song marked a significant moment in the direction of the band. Then in 1987, it took on a new life as Nike released a 60-second commercial for Air Shoes, and it was set to Revolution. It was the first and only time that a Beatles song has featured in an advert, and it sparked a chain of events that transformed the art of branding. So next week, I'll be speaking to Alan Bradshaw all about that and his book Advertising Revolution. That's all from me this week. Vincent McAvaney will be here to do the papers on Sunday Brunch next week. And coming up, it's Oscar Jerome on the Midori House Sessions. But for now, from me, Georgina, thank you for listening.